The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome you to the Free Library of Philadelphia. It's going to be another wonderful evening of intellectual conversation. The Free Library is a critical institution to the city of Philadelphia and libraries in general, because libraries are a place where everyone is welcome, regardless of gender, regardless of background, regardless of income. It's a place for conversations, for education and entertainment. So I urge you to support the Free Library of Philadelphia. I urge you to support libraries in general, because in particularly this day and age, we need to build community. We need to have conversations about solving problems. Just one word of history I picked up. Last year, we had 123 lectures here at this auditorium, and we had 34,570 individuals that came and participated in what I call the intellectual treasure chest. So again, support the Free Library of Philadelphia, because I just heard earlier today about additional immigrants coming in and using the branches, and English as a second language, and the services that the library provides for them. So it's critical, and it needs our support, both dollars and politically, in terms of talking to members of City Council and the mayor. Enough. Let's move on to talk about Joe Ellis. He is this marvelous author about the American Fathers, and his new book, American Dialogue, The Founders and Us, I urge you to buy it. It's a terrific book, and he'll be interviewed tonight by Jason Freeman from the author series. The staff of the Free Library Authors events who manage these 123 events from last year really deserve our praise. They are the unsung heroes of what takes place here at the Free Library. Just a couple of additional pieces of information about Joe Ellis that captured my attention. As some of you know, I'm a proud graduate of Duke University and very excited about Duke basketball in particular. But Joe informed me this evening as we were talking over dinner that after getting his PhD from Yale, he had an Army commitment, having served in the ROTC at William & Mary, where he did his undergraduate work. And he had an opportunity, instead of going to Vietnam, to go to West Point. And he decided that was an easy decision, so he went there and taught history for 3 years. But they had a course that every sophomore at West Point had to take, and maybe some of us probably should do these days. It was called From Plato to NATO. And one of his students was Mike Krzyzewski, who has gone on to be the legendary coach at in the Q&A, when you wish to ask a question, be sure you ask a question, no speeches, but you can ask him about West Point as well as Mount Holyoke, where he spent a distinguished time teaching there, and I know we've got some very proud graduates of Mount Holyoke in the audience tonight, as always. But in any event, welcome to the Free Library, and let's give Joe Ellis a wonderful Philadelphia welcome.
Thank you very much, Morris, for that wonderful, wonderful introduction. Unsung we are. So thank you all for being here. Rather than listening to me, I just want to jump right in and get to as many questions from this really deep dive kind of book as I can, so we can get to your wonderful questions. Again, as Morris said, to be phrased as questions. I'm also told this is the first stop on Professor Ellis's book tour, so that is both delightful and terrifying for me.
That means I won't have heard these before, so I won't be ready for them. But
right, we're all about the gotcha questions here. So the beginning, as they say, is a very good place to start. I'd like to even talk about the title of this book, about how this dialogue is occurring, why, aside from you being one of the foremost experts on this period, you believe that it's so fundamental that we return to the truths, complexities, and even contradictions of the Founding Fathers.
That's a large question. I will try to give you a succinct answer. We don't know how to talk to each other anymore. We don't know how to argue with each other anymore. And I've seen it in my own lifetime, even. The apps do that. You'd think that the internet would be a source of communication. It's become a source of isolation. And the more I look at it, the more the term better angels of our nature looks like a naive idea. So we live in a troubled time where we're divided and people watch Fox or MSNBC and they listen to their different apps. You have to be very mindful that you're talking to this audience rather than that audience. And the kind of civic center that this institution embodies is really rare, a place where people of different persuasions and backgrounds and race and income can come together on equal terms. So in some sense, the title of the book means we need to learn how to talk to each other, but we need most to learn how to argue with each other. In the end, the founders succeeded in part because they were a diverse group, not racially diverse, but intellectually and temperamentally and ideologically diverse. The picture of the American Revolution and the American founding is not a single portrait, it's a group portrait. It was a collective. If Jefferson alone was in charge, we would have ended up in an anarchy. If Hamilton were in charge, we'd end up in an autocracy. In the same way that there's checks and balances allegedly built into, really built into the Constitution, there were checks and balances built into the generation, and they could argue. And the greatest example of this is the final correspondence between Adams and Jefferson between 1812 and 1826, the North and South poles of the American Revolution. Adams beginning by saying, "You and I ought not to die until we have explained ourselves to each other." So there's a model back there, in the same way that the founders went back to Thucydides and Tacitus and Plutarch and Cicero, I'm going back to Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, or not Hamilton. I know I should do Hamilton. It would be commercially to my advantage. My granddaughter said, "Why not?" And Washington, who is the other person I write about? Jefferson, Adams, Madison, and Washington. And I'm doing something, I'm talking to them. Historians aren't supposed to do this, okay? Historians aren't supposed to self-consciously pose questions of the past formed in the present. It's called presentism. That's a sin. Everybody's doing it, and I'm joining them.
And I'm very happy you did. Let's go back to a figure you mentioned. It's always auspicious when we have historians of this period here in Philadelphia, perhaps you particularly. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence at 7th and Market Streets. He and that document are such quandaries to us. And I keep going back to the same words when I read this book, paradox and irony. And all of these things. So,
if that's what comes to you, I'm winning, yes.
Okay. Will you discuss the paradoxes of Jefferson and that document at length in the book? Can you elaborate on what confounds us so about them? Is that a big question, too?
Yeah, that's a biggie. On 7th and Market Street on a second floor apartment on a portable desk built by a former slave in the middle weeks of June of 1776, Jefferson wrote the magic words of American history, the one that begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." This is the American creed. It is the catechismic foundation for the liberal tradition in the United States. It is the reason why, you know how Supreme Court justices, especially when testifying, say that, you know, "I'm just an umpire, I just call balls and strikes." What I say to them is, first of all, baseball didn't exist in 1787. Second, the strike zone has been expanding for the last 200 years. And it's been expanding in terms of what those words mean. And gosh knows, we can talk a lot about that. That's a whole seminar. Jefferson simultaneously firmly believed that blacks and whites could not live together in the same society. And the reason why he couldn't lead America towards a gradual emancipation policy, and he had the opportunity to do it when he was president in the Louisiana Purchase, is that he genuinely believed that once the slaves were freed, they had to be sent somewhere else. He could not envision a biracial society. And any biracial society, in his judgment, would become a society that corrupted the purity of the Anglo-Saxon race. That's what he thought. And he never assumed a leadership position on slavery, because he believed that until we could come up with a plan to deport them, initially thought the American West, then he said, "No, that's not good. That's where we're going to put the Native Americans." Liberia, maybe, but best the Caribbean, Santo Domingo, probably. And that's his last word. I mean, he never changed his mind on this. And that's the reason he's so important, because we're encountering in this moment a society, an American society, in which a significant minority of Americans share the same prejudices that he did. Those have never died. The arc of the moral universe, said Martin Luther King, tends towards justice. That's true. We don't live in the moral universe. We live in the United States. And in my judgment, I devote two chapters to this. The chapter on race is called Abiding Backlash. So that the pattern, according to the optimistic liberal view, is, you know, gradual improvement over time on the race question. And that's true, but this is the real pattern. And we're in a backlash moment. We're down here. And a significant portion of the American populace has never accepted the full implications of the civil rights movement. They're not just people in the former Confederacy either. And this is ripe stuff. As we approach 2045, and the white population then is scheduled to become a statistical minority, even though it will retain the bulk of the economic and political power, we can fully expect demagogues. This is fertile ground for demagogues. Trump is just the first. And in the end, King was right, but getting there is going to be hard and a struggle. Like cancer, we'll keep getting better, but we'll never cure it.
Well, this actually leads to my next thought, too. You crack this book, and you know it's going to be something a little different because it starts with the last line from The Great Gatsby, you know, and so we beat all boats against the current, born ceaselessly back into the past. And it's populated by, you know, great thinkers, great minds between then and now. And the one I was most fascinated with you citing is James Baldwin. Mm. How do you see him as the most important, I want to say, I was trying to phrase this, and I said countervoice, but that doesn't sound quite correct. But how do you see him as the end conclusion of the Jefferson?
Baldwin's a weird choice. I mean, he's been dead for over a generation, and in his time, he was dismissed by militants as like Uncle Tom, and then by the whites as a radical. And he, as a gay guy, he was also, you know, dismissed on those grounds. And he was an expatriate. He lived in Paris the last 40 years of his life. Although, actually, we hired him up at Mount Holyoke for the last 5 years of his life in the Valley. And the three black guys I found most interesting on the race question were Baldwin, W.B. Du Bois, and a sociologist at Harvard, what's the guy's name? William Julius Wilson. What Baldwin does is say something that I think was truly prophetic. This was in Notes of a Native Son in 1955. He said, while the great achievement and challenge of American history has been the creation of a democracy in a continent-sized population, that challenge pales in comparison to the challenge still faced of sharing that democracy with black men. He should have said, and women. What he's saying is that the belief in a interracial, biracial, interracial society is reasonably recent. It's a mid-20th century American idea. None of the founders could imagine it. Jefferson included, most specifically, and given the fact that he was having these relationships with Sally, makes it even more hypocritical, it seems. But Baldwin, partly because he was gay and he could occupy different sides of the gender and the racial identities, and because he was an expatriate, he used to say things like, you know, blacks going back to Africa, you're crazy. Blacks are Americans, and the Americans will solve the racial problem before the French will because they have experience living together. But go back and read Notes of a Native Son, and it's got stuff in there that really speaks to us.
Let's talk about John Adams.
My favorite guy.
I know it, and it shines through so prescient, so canonized by us. And speaking as one of the 99% has so much interesting material to say about income inequality. And here's something I don't think that we necessarily think about. He said it was ludicrous to believe that all men are actually created equal. And you mentioned the irony of a slaveholder from Virginia lecturing a farmer's son from Massachusetts.
Mm, on equality, yeah.
Can you discuss this irony, this discussion they had, and what he saw as the problem and how it relates to today?
Adams,
I told you I wouldn't get
Adams is, yeah, I've been talking making too long, Mike. But Adams has come back in the scholarly world in a big way because his papers are coming out, and he's showing himself to be the most interesting and fully revealed of the founders. I mean, in the Washington diary, if you look at his diary, it's about the weather. So the last day of his presidency, and you think he's leaving public life. What are the great thoughts he's got? Washington, you know, April 2nd, 1796, a day like all days, 25 degrees centigrade, you know. That's it. For Adams, he always talks about the weather inside his own soul. about the storms inside himself. And Adams is, and that's the major reason he's come back, plus McCulloch's biography and all that. But that there are other reasons we should find him interesting, and that's what Jason is referring to. He's the only one of the founders that predicts the Gilded Age. He's the only one of the founders who says that equality in the marketplace will lead to inequality socially and politically. And he's based on reading Adam Smith, he thinks the Scottish philosophers are more important and more interesting than the French philosophers, who are Jefferson's guys. The French philosophers are dominated, says Adams, by ideology, which is a term that they coin. D'Estout de Tracy coins this term. He says, what is ideology? Is it Adams says, it's the science of non-compos mentis. And what he says, it's the delusion that because you can imagine something in your mind, it's possible in the world. Okay? And this is the delusion that leads to the guillotine and the firing squad wall, okay? And he believes that everyone comes into the world as equal in terms of human beings with rights, but they come with fundamentally different abilities, with different opportunities. And of course that's true, and that's going to lead in a way that Jefferson can anticipate to an aristocracy of wealth. Because the Americans don't have a natural aristocracy in the way Britain and Europe does, the American aristocracy will be a plutocracy. And it will take over the government, and once that happens, it'll be difficult to dislodge it. Guess what? We're there again. And he doesn't have an answer. His answers are curious. I mean, you know, put all the aristocrats in the Senate. They will be ostracized there, he said, because that's where they have power, for God's sakes. But he says one thing is not an answer, what we would call supply-side economics. Trickle-down will not work, as if we need to be told, right? Although there are a lot of people in America that apparently continue to believe it. But that once you have income inequality in major ways, you will have plutocracy. We have it. People in Congress, both parties, most especially the Republicans, but both parties, their primary constituency is not the voter. It's the donor. That's true. And, you know, when the Second Amendment was, they were talking about, you know, legislation after Sandy Hook, and 90% of the Americans wanted limitations on handguns and greater background checks. 90%. You can't get 90% to agree on anything. It never had a chance. NRA money never had a chance. So Adams sees that. Adams is my kind of guy, too, because he's a contrarian. And when things are, you know, and he said things like, the greatest thing I ever did as president was lose the election of 1800. Because I lost it because I did the right thing. I avoided war with France. I knew if I did that, I would lose the election. How many politicians today would do the right thing when it cost them the election? I can't think of a single one. And even, you know, the woman from North Dakota, she was going to lose anyway, okay? But it is assumed that you as a candidate or as a congressman or senator have to have your own reelection as the highest priority. None of the founders would understand that at all. They would think that's, you know, if that's the case, count me out. None of them won for president in this common. It's you know, prostitution, as far as they're concerned.
One of my favorite lines in the book is, you say, Adams is most relevant when he is most irreverent. And I truly love that. And I could honestly spend the next half hour talking about your thoughts, well, his thoughts as you have listed them here, but there's a couple other topics I really want to get into, and one is so incendiary and so of this moment.
I know where this is going.
The concept of originalism as it pertains to interpretations of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights by our Supreme Court, which I don't know if you know that was in the news, everybody. Can you talk about this notion of originalism, and especially as it pertains to one Supreme Court justice?
You're not talking about the currently, most recently appointed one, I hope.
No, I'm talking about a dearly departed
one. The one that's deceased.
Yes.
Mr. Scalia.
Yes.
Yeah. I have two chapters on the law, and the guy on the law from on the founder's side, the then side, is Madison. And I follow his career from 1785 to 1790 and his mental process as he's creating, then defending the Constitution and drafting the Bill of Rights. By the way, nobody called it the Bill of Rights then. It wasn't called the Bill of Rights until the 20th century. It was called the First Ten Amendments. And Madison didn't think they should go at the end. He tried to put them into the document to cram them in. And then he couldn't do that because he couldn't figure out where to put it. And he didn't believe in it. He said that they have no effect on, if the Democratic majorities want to do something, they'll override these paper principles. The reason I'm doing this is to encourage the people who are reluctant to join the new nation, that were Confederationists or Anti-Federalists, that we're trying to fold them in. They wanted a Bill of Rights. Okay, originalism. Originalism is a judicial doctrine that was first created by Robert Bork at Chicago in the 70s. And Chicago is a school which believes in the great books, something I like. And but this is an application of the great books philosophy to the law, and that the Constitution is the equivalent of the ancient Greek texts, and the eternal truths are buried there if we can find them. This would be a judicial doctrine that would have enjoyed some brief measure of success at elite law schools for a period of time and then be replaced by some more fashionable theory. But it stuck because it became a weaponized doctrine to undermine the liberal principles and the precedents, of the 20th century court. Because if they're right, the originalists claim, originally they claimed that the original intentions of the framers would guide. Now they've changed that to the original meaning. The difference between those things is more verbal than real. What they're saying is they want to recover the mentality of the people at that moment. And this, to me, is utterly preposterous. It's not sort of, well, I don't completely agree. This is like, are you kidding me? You're on my turf. And you can't play here. You don't know what they were saying. You haven't read it. This is all a device. And I do a close analysis of Scalia's opinion in D.C. versus Heller, which he regards as his masterpiece of originalism. And I suggest it's a labyrinthian trip through Alice in Wonderland. And there is a kind of law school history, too, that's interesting. Remember, if you're a lawyer, you're given your client. Your job is to mount the evidence that supports your client and suppress the evidence that is bad. And that's what Scalia does. Historians can't do that. You're not allowed to do that. Historians are on the one hand or on the other hand, and paradox and irony. It doesn't have to come out a verdict, yes, no, guilty, not. It shouldn't, in fact. And so the law of its history is perfectly okay. It's like debaters, you know, who can hit, land on the triple word score. Read the book and you'll reach your own conclusion, but that in my judgment, the doctrine of originalism is a doctrine which claims on the base, it claims to be the only detached approach to the Constitution. And it is, in fact, the most ideologically prejudiced of all.
Again, an irony that Jefferson refuted that in his own lifetime, correct? So
he was a letter, 1816, which he says, for you to try to do what we did or to use our words would be like a man trying to put on the coat that he wore when he was a child. Actually, Jefferson believed the Constitution should be redone every generation.
Well, who knows?
Madison
maybe we're going to start.
Nuts when he told him this. I've been working on this thing for this. You want to redo it every 21 years?
I'd like to get to one more of these figures before we get to your questions, who I just think is so elusive, enigmatic, inscrutable, and purposefully so by himself, and that's George Washington. And one of my favorite things that you write is there are no words written on the Washington Monument, very tellingly. He had his wife burn his papers, and he had very few close confidants. And I want to look
just
at
their
his
letters,
actions.
Not the whole papers. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. What I found so interesting, I think a lot of us who are interested in this period know of Washington's farewell address, but there's material in there that if you learn a little bit more about the context, takes on all of these new layers. And the first architect of American foreign policy was George Washington. And can you talk about how he is specifically and obliquely addressing that in the farewell address and the specific experience that led him to that?
The farewell address is a document that achieves a certain level of iconic stature over the course of the 19th century as the prescription for American isolation. America should have commercial relations with all the world, but diplomatic relations with none. That the future for America is the West. It's not across the Atlantic in Europe. It's the opening up of this unbelievable continent, which happens to be occupied by about 1 million Native Americans. And Washington thinks about that, by the way, and I'll answer questions about that. But that particular verdict was based on geographic and demographic considerations in the realist tradition. Washington is a realist. Jefferson is an idealist. Washington believes that interest drives decisions. That's the reason why the Jay Treaty, he abandons the French. The French saved our bacon in the American Revolution. Well, that was then, this is now. Okay, we sell them out in 1796. Our interest has shifted. And for Jefferson, ideals are the reality, and of course, once you pursue that far enough, you end up at the guillotine, Robespierre, etc. But Washington's prescription for isolation dies in the late 19th century and early 20th century when we move from a rural to an urban country and become the major economic power. And the attempt to implement it in the interwar years is a catastrophe. Mainly as we walk away from global power status, what happens but the rise of Hitler, Mussolini, fascism, and Japan? So we know as historians that that was not work. But if you attempt to apply Jefferson's realism to our situation now, the verdict I offer you, and you can argue with this, is that we are perfectly positioned as a superpower. No other superpower exists between the Atlantic and the Pacific, can go both ways. And in an interdisciplinary, in a global world, isolation is impossible. It doesn't exist anymore. And the question is not whether we will be a superpower, but what kind of superpower we are going to be. And on that score, I'll quickly There are a couple things that Washington has to tell us. One, remember, we began as an anti-imperial power. People would ask me when I was on the road on a Washington biography, what would Washington do about Iraq? I said, first of all, he wouldn't know where Iraq was. Secondly, he would say, how did we get to be the British? Okay? Secondly, we're the first republic with a democratic foundation. A republic, res publica, believes that the ultimate answer is consensus. An empire believes the ultimate answer is coercion. A republic cannot be an empire, yet we sort of are. What does that mean? Because we're a democracy, a clock is running on all American commitments abroad. And eventually they will lose favor. And exceptionalism to Washington means exactly the opposite of what exceptionalism means to most people now. Now it means, you know, God takes care of women and children in the United States of America, right? And that we're the chosen people. Washington said no, precisely because we had a unique set of conditions when we started. The land that we had, the distance. Our experience is not transportable to other countries. In his time, he meant France. But in our time, he would mean the Middle East. Anybody that thinks they're going to plant Jeffersonian seeds of democracy in the sands of the Middle East needs to have his or her head examined. Okay? That's not going to work. And there's certain places in the world it's not going to work. And we shouldn't try. And we should know that. And his, you know, for him, the city on a hill is a good idea. The perfection of our own society as a model for the world rather than attempt to impose it by military power.
I have two more questions very quickly, and then we'll get to yours. One, it's both a delightful anecdote, and I think it's very telling to today, and kind of leads to my second question about how these we tend to, a lot of people since their deaths and even in their own time have cast these men in marble. But it's important to note that George Washington himself was a victim of fake news. Could you talk about that a little? It is so crazy and raunchy and fun in the book.
Yeah, when in the second term he was criticized. He was the major newspaper of the Republican opposition. It's Republicans, not Democratic Republicans. They don't call themselves that till later. Jeffersonian Party. Benjamin Franklin Bache, Franklin's grandson, is the editor. Francis Prince Story saying that Washington, we've uncovered secret papers, which turn out to be forgeries, that he was a British spy throughout the war. And that he was intending to turn us, you know, to turn on us, but Benedict Arnold beat him to the punch. These were actually British documents that they had distributed to try to undermine Washington. In his farewell address, it's called The Loathings of a Sick Mind. We devoutly pray for your imminent death. This is Washington, right? And so there's all kinds of crazy things going on then, as well as there is now, fake news. It's a bitter party warfare in the 1790s. It's a bitter party warfare. The internet has made things more, has given greater range to this than existed then. I don't think they would be that surprised at fake news.
Right.
Or what's called that. And in that sense, what makes them helpful to us is while they're really different, they're not totally different. Okay, there's enough there for us to see ourselves in and to learn from. For Washington, what I've just said before is we can't stop being a world power. The current president is never going to have that happen. We're the number one economic and military power in the world. Nobody's even close. Our geographic position is wonderful. but it's what kind of willpower we are.
Man, Philadelphians have never taken it easy on people. Benjamin Franklin's grandson.
Yes.
So my last question before we get to yours, it comes up time and again in the book, and I was briefly mentioning it, the mythologizing of these men in their lifetimes afterwards turned into, you know, shown us in marble. Adams and Washington in particular eschewed that sort of deification even. And I think in this book you don't struggle. You very beautifully turn them back into flesh and blood people. I suppose
If you put Adams on Mount Rushmore, it would have to be flesh rather than marble, you know, or granite.
Right. I suppose, and you can answer this question as an historian or you personally. Why do you think it's so important to turn these people back into flesh and blood?
Because if they're really gods, what in heaven's name can we learn from them? If that's what they are, none of us, I have not seen anybody here who is, and I know I'm not. The fact that they're flawed figures is what makes them truly important and relevant, and people whose struggles we can learn from. And it is probably inevitable that all new nations create mythical heroes. Rome has Romulus and Remus, England has King Arthur, and Spain has El Cid. The difference is all those are fictional characters. These guys are real. And they cared so much about the fact that we would be thinking about them, they would imagine that the Free Library in October of 2018 would have a couple hundred people sitting there talking about them. They were the audience, you are the audience, we are the audience they were performing for. They didn't believe in life after death, many of them. Washington didn't, Adams didn't, Jefferson didn't, Franklin certainly didn't. Adams said, if it can ever be shown conclusively that there is no life after death, my advice to every man, woman, and child on the planet is to take opium.
That is a wonderful time to take your questions, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, round of applause. So I believe that a great majority of you know how this works. We have two volunteers coming with microphones. If you raise your hand, I will choose this gentleman first. And again, please keep your questions brief so we can get to as many of your fellow patrons as possible. Go ahead, sir.
You indicated that Jefferson did not really believe in a biracial society. If you would look
at... Yet he created just that society at Monticello.
Look at every president between Lincoln and Eisenhower, and do you think any of them actually believed in a biracial society, and did they take steps toward achieving it?
The only one is Truman. That's the only one.
I suspect that you think... You might think Citizens United distorts the political process. If you agree with that, and given the new makeup of the court, what's the workaround to get us back on track?
It's really simple. We only need 100 million frontal lobotomies. I think that... Citizens United is probably the worst Supreme Court decision since Dred Scott. And it won't be overturned until we face a crisis that forces us to reconsider certain assumptions that are rooted in capitalism. Which I believe in capitalism, by the way, okay? And by the way, socialist, you know, any use of government power is often described as socialist by especially people on the right. As Casey Sengel said, you can look it up. Socialism is government ownership of the means of production. It means the end of private property. There are very few socialists, including Bernie Sanders, in the United States. What they're talking about is regulated capitalism. I think that that leadership only emerges in crisis. It doesn't mean it will emerge if there is a crisis, but it won't without one. And the crisis I see is climate change. And I think that's coming faster than we knew, and it's going to force us to face things that will make Citizens United look like something that is obviously the wrong direction. If I was to predict this, I've never said this before, and I just realized what I think this. I think that we're going to respond to climate change the same way we responded to slavery. There was a way to end it if we caught it early, by the early 19th century, by 1820. Once it got past that, the Cotton Kingdom was too valuable, too many slaves. And then that meant the war. I think that's what's going to happen on climate change. We're going to know too late. And then it's really going to be evacuate the coasts. And God, I don't know how that plays out after that.
Thank you for your pessimism. I wish everybody could listen. You mentioned that these gentlemen were addressing us as an audience.
Yes.
I'm not sure that that's accurate in context, because you can't talk Jefferson without Jimmy Callender. You can't talk Adams without Peter Porcupine. Could you comment a little further without getting all the way down to fake news?
Yeah, he's talking about people that wrote about them at the time. And what I'm saying is that they left us a legacy of writing. Because they knew we would be here, they preserved their work, their writing, their letters, in a way that almost no other political elite in recorded history has done. We have the fullest record of this group as a political elite than any other group in recorded history. The Adams papers are in 87 volumes. I don't know where the Washington papers are now, 70-some, I think. So we know much about them. Now, they can't come to us. They are busy being dead. But we can go to them, because they left it there, okay? And so a woman can go back and read Abigail Adams' March 31st, 1776 letter, and start to think about feminism as something that's serious. And was she a feminist? But that in that sense, they still speak to us. They speak to us in the documents they left us. And that's really important.
I wonder if you would speak a little on how you wrote this book. Obviously, the contemporary aspect of it is a little bit different than your historical ones. Did you just sit in a room and think about it, or did you go out and talk to a lot of people involved in the more pressing contemporary issues?
I wrote it this way. With a pen, not a quill pen. I don't write on a typewriter. You're right. There's a difference between the chapters. The then chapters are with material that I'm well known. I mean, I've read all the founders' papers that I'm writing about there. When you move into now, you're into journalistic territory. And what I tried to do is write about them historically, to see the patterns of race over time, the patterns on the law, for example. I'm attempting to write about the present with the historian's assumptions. I talk to a lot of people who are journalists and friends of mine, who work on the New York Times, the blog of the New Republic, which no longer exists, and but mostly I read stuff. If you want to know about what's going on out there, it's a New Yorker book called The Unwinding. George Baker, is it?
Packard,
excuse me, yes. Oh, God. early Alzheimer's. And another New Yorker writer, Dark Money, is really unbelievable. Jane Mayer. That's just. But then a lot of op-eds, and there's bibliographies in the book on what I read, but I struggled with it. That is, my process of thinking is a digestion process that comes with reading and then trying to write and then going back to read some more, and it's a struggle. This was a struggle for me in a way that some of my other books were not, because you know you're working with stuff that's very contemporary. But even though our nose is up against the window in Trump land right now, I wanted to step back and say Trump's important because of what he's an airburst in the night that is showing us who we really are. And I started working on this before Trump was a name throughout the land in 2014. So that the racial problems, the economic inequality problems, the problems with the law. I mean, I didn't go into stuff like, let's get rid of the Electoral College. They would have been amazed that we still have the Electoral College. They thought it was a disaster the day after they did it. And it was a compromise. Let's figure out a way to equalize voting in the Senate. North and South Dakota have 4 senators. The total population of North and South Dakota is less than Los Angeles. Figure that out. And we need a second constitutional convention. The founders would be amazed that this thing has lasted as long as it has. Madison said, in writing in 1829, said, if it lasts for another 100 years, it'll be a miracle. Think if it had ended in 1929. I mean, it would, you know, like the Depression. And though it's impossible to imagine a second constitutional convention. Almost everything that I want to have happen is impossible to imagine. Okay? I want to have mandatory national service for everybody between 18 and 25. If only we could control the Congress, we would get it through. There's lots of things like that, but we're in that kind of moment. I expect to see leadership over the next 5 years coming from outside mainstream politics. Martin Luther King could have never been elected. Anybody in mainstream politics now is going to eventually be swallowed up by the plutocracy.
And I don't think he pointed out, but also in answer to your question, amidst my research, I saw that you don't use research assistants. Right. And so take that, you lazy tenured academics out there who don't who rely on poor graduate students.
No, I mean, I don't know how to supervise them. You know, like, you know, they say, well, what should I look at? Well, I don't know it until I look at it myself, what you should look at. And I mean, like, one time I discovered that Washington sent General Howe his dog. He found this dog, a greyhound, on the battlefield and sent it back. And I thought, if I had a research assistant, they would have never found that sucker. You know, they would have never noticed it. And so there are things like these raisins in the dough that you know, that's what you read the history. That's what you do research for.
To be fair, that would have been the one detail I told you. all right, back here, we had a question, sir?
Yeah.
Ma'am?
I wanted to ask the question you invited about Washington's view of the rest of the continent and the role of Native Americans in the future
Yes.
of the country.
Yeah. Washington was born into a world in which Indians were a big thing, and the Native Americans were powerful. And he understood Native Americans better than any of the other founders. When president, and this is something that a lot of people don't know, and I don't know how they can, people that write about the presidency of Washington don't even talk about it. Washington made the Native American question his major domestic policy issue in the first term of his presidency. He wanted to negotiate a treaty with the Native Americans, with certain tribes. He became the Creeks, that would create a series of homelands east of the Mississippi that would avoid Indian removal. He thought Indian removal was a violation of the values on which the revolution were based. Artillery commander, Henry Knox, was prompting him on this. If you don't do this right and avoid Indian removal, it will be a stain on your legacy, and the people at the Free Library will not come to hear a lecture about you. And so they created this treaty with this guy called McGillivray, who was the Creek Treat. He was chief. He was an amazing character. But they're like, there's a scene like the, you know, these Native American chiefs come all the way up from Georgia to New York, and there's like 27 of them fully bonneted riding in. They live next to Abigail and John, and they make her an honorary Creek Indian, call her Mama, and they do, and they sign this treaty, and it's arm to elbow, and it's like the only moment of real possibility in American-Indian relations. And it doesn't work because you can't enforce it. That the states of Georgia and South Carolina simply won't recognize the Indian rights. And what Washington foresaw was a series of homelands east of the Mississippi that would be bypassed by American settlers. You couldn't trade them, be protected by American troops. And over time, those settlements would go smaller as they became not hunting and gathering societies, but farming societies. And eventually, over the century, they would be assimilated. Jefferson never thought the blacks could be assimilated. He thought Indians could be assimilated. He made a heroic effort, Washington did, and it failed. It was the biggest failure of his presidency, and he regretted it to the end of his life. And he said, the only way to make it work is to build a Chinese wall. Before there was Trump's wall, there was Washington's wall to protect the Indians, okay? But it failed.
Given your general pessimism, what makes you feel that the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice?
There we go. We needed that after tonight, please.
Given my pessimism on many issues as I've articulated it here, what makes me think the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice? My book ends with a quote from Tocqueville. It's Tocqueville's last lines. I'm full of apprehension and hope. Because I have to, because I'm going to die in 20 years and I don't want to die an unhappy guy, because I think you want to hear it. because maybe it's true. Hitler, what happened in Europe says no. Reed Snyder on tyranny. There's a lot of precedents working against us. So I don't have an answer. It's just hope. Why do you believe in God? Faith. I don't believe in God. But I believe there is such a thing as morality. And I believe the pattern over time in American history is towards greater racial acceptance. That's true. That makes me feel better. There is a basic pattern. And anybody that doesn't recognize that is nuts. And so, all these reasons. But there's a pattern that suggests that's where, after we finish this downturn, we're going up again.
There we go. Well, it may not have all the answers. No one does, but it poses some very fascinating questions. What a wonderful dialogue you had with me. I appreciate it with all of these folks. And ladies and gentlemen, one more round of applause for Joseph Ellis.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.